quarter short of a dollar and a drink. Blue collar worker surviving no collard green. What it means though, spice of life is jalapenos. Life is like a box of chocolates, Mike and Ike's, man, I ain't gotta lie. Look in the mirror, eye to eye, so the only man I idolize. I work 5 to 9 after these 9 to 5s. Arrive at $1 million studios and 95 trucks. With my 10-year-old jeans, wearing 95 chucks. Say it right, these beats, they'll be riding your nuts. They'll be mighty high, strong, or the right amount of luck. You attack some pussy like a gynecologist. Now I'm knocking off the dust, hoping I'll be hopping off the bus. The show's on Sunset like I'm wrapping up the dust. Singing love came, pay the bills.
Podcasting doesn't pay the bills either, Haas, but that's okay. Another week, another show. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Bedroom Beethovens, the podcast where I meditate on pivotal moments in various musical people's lives, how they broke through fears and challenges to invent new opportunities and change the scope of being artists in their fields. And yo, I just wanted to say that I'm getting fan mail. Shout out to QLV. I won't use your full name for obvious reasons, but he emailed me and told me he really appreciates the stories of the guests, even when he hasn't heard of them before. So with that said, there's a certain joy to record this podcast, you know, getting good at what you do and languishing in obscurity in the interim. But, you know, just to help with the process, I have created a Patreon. Patreon is a great site that makes it easy for fans to get more involved in the creative process of the artists they love. So joining me on Patreon means you'll gain access to exclusive content, early episodes, and personalized rewards. You can pick how much you pledge and change your subscription level at any point. You can give as little as $2 just to show your support, and I'll use it to better the show. So head on over to patreon.com/bedroombeethovens. Also, these episodes are on YouTube. Go over there and hit that subscribe button, even if you don't watch the show over there. It's just a way to show your support and help this ship grow. All right, guys, my guest is Matt Rose. He reached out to me. He reached out to me. I told you I was gaining traction. He writes, produces, and arranges all of his music.
Mass endangerment, laws. Ignore the voice of the shepherd, and I bet you get a lot of what's heard. What's Rose gold? Who's gold? Who knows? Speak it when you think it's absurd. And he asks, excuse me, do I owe you an apology for the way I choose to live my life? Excuse me, do I owe you an apology for the way I choose to live?
Music should strike fire from the heart of man and bring tears from the eyes of women. To me, that's Matt Rose's music. At the top of the year, he has this dope song called Apology. And at the moment of this episode hitting the streets, he's headlining his first national tour, doing 7 shows across 5 cities. So big things. And if you haven't heard of Matt Rose, strap in, because you will. I'm your host, Cello. Yo, Lamont Landers Band, tell the good people what podcast they're tuned into.
It's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
Exactly, which I'm ultra grateful for.
Yeah, I know we can't see each other face to face here, but and I'm about to throw out a bunch of generic terms like multifaceted artist and the like, but I need to take a moment and just let you know how dope you are.
Oh, man, thank you. I really appreciate that. I really do.
Yeah, well, I think compliments can fly by the wayside or be taken lightly, but I really wanted to put emphasis on that because, you know, you have a handful of singles out, and each one, man, are like summer anthems. So you know, the sky really is the limit, and I'm just really excited to sit down and learn more about you.
Sweet. Yeah, man, it's definitely been an interesting journey just to get here and to get those songs out, and just stand and amazed at how much support I've been able to get in from an artist standpoint, I guess, not even necessarily from like people I don't know, but actually just like in my own community, it's made a huge difference. So I don't take it lightly.
Yeah. And I think the rules of the podcast is like, if you're a singer, if you're a rapper, nope, sorry, you can't be on the podcast. But if you're all those things and a producer and a writer, I mean, your hat rack must be large because you wear a lot of them.
Well, yeah, I guess so. In a weird way, you know, I was never one of those people who's like, I'm about to learn how to do this. I'm gonna learn how to do this. It was more just something that kind of fell into my lap as I went along, like, oh, you know, I rap. I wanted to produce, but I couldn't really do it, so I started rap instead. singing and stuff like that, and then working with other producers and trying to find a way to articulate the things that I want to do opened up the channel to be like, I need to learn more about this so I can tell people what I want, not necessarily so I can make it myself. But I guess the end goal kind of ends up being the same.
Yeah, I mean, do labels even know what to do with versatility nowadays? Because it seems you hear like labels want to box you in to appeal to a certain demographic, and it must have been crazy not only juggling genres, but without having a full project out in retail to like prove your salt, you're able to incorporate different genres in your music. And this is coming from just a handful of songs that I've heard. So you must be like right now, you must be in fight or flight mode, I imagine.
Yeah, dude. Honestly, so. I mean, long journey behind the scenes before anything ever came out. And to be quite honest, we've talked to a few different labels, and it always kind of fits the same format where, you know, first they call you into the room, you know, you're hyped to be there. You have this long table in a room, and they're telling you about how great your music is. And they play a few tunes, and they tell you what they like about it. And it's always like starts off with a great vibe. But by the time the end of that meeting, or even the next meeting when they call you back in, it's like, oh yeah, so we love all this stuff, but we just want you to sound a little more like this. We just want you to be a little more like this. And to be honest, you know, it goes into another, there's so many different aspects of where that conversation can go in terms of like mastery of craft or just like how you genuinely feel personally about your music. But at the end of the day, it is somewhat of a business, and there definitely is room for critique and to incorporate different things and just explore avenues. But it's the difference between being like, hey, look, like I have these collections of songs that I made that I want to be a certain way. They have an artistic integrity versus like having someone, you know, tell you to change that, but versus them being like, hey, why don't we just make a song to add this to your catalog as well? And it's usually the former. It's usually like they want you to change your songs. They don't want to put the effort into making a new song. You know what I'm saying? Which is odd, because as an artist, I'm like, you know what? If you guys want me to make something like this because you feel like the single or the album or the collection of music doesn't have this sound, let's do that. Why does it always have to be something where I'm placing my current stuff in a box for you? You know? It's weird.
Yeah. It's so easy for me to sit back in my chair and tell you, like, the best way to get recognized is only when you embrace the fact that you're different. But not everyone has that freedom. And it's not even an insecurity issue. Like you say, you walk into that room, you see that big conference table. And if you don't have a thick skin, it could go sideways.
Easily. Very, very easily. And I remember specifically I was in the room with this publishing company based out of L.A. and just kind of going through that and then being like, oh, we just, you know, it's not like we want to change everything. It's just like, you know, this, you know, maybe we just change a little bit of the chorus here. Maybe we just change, you know, a hi-hat here. Maybe the beat shouldn't drop here. And it's like, yeah, but when you change those things, you're changing the feeling of the song. You're changing the intention of the song. You're changing like what I originally wanted to say as an artist. And from an artist standpoint, obviously it's different. Like you can come at it from like a business standpoint where it's like, oh yeah, you might need those things. But if you're coming at it from, you know, 50-50, it's like, I'm not necessarily so ready to bend over backwards for someone I just met a day ago about a promise about being a superstar. You're like, you know what I'm saying? This isn't porn, man. You can't just walk in a room and be like, I'm gonna make you a star. Yeah. Like, you know, so, you know, it's just kind of like, I think, you know, to bring it back, I think labels just have kind of lost touch with what it really means to be an artist aside from the business standpoint. And I think a lot of the stuff that I see that I'm not attracted to is when that is really apparent, when it's like, oh, this is so obviously a cookie cutter thing that they just pulled out the box, you know, to have this artist, you know, reach the masses. But, you know, the reality is that if you want to play the numbers game, you know, it doesn't matter if your song sounds like garbage. You know, you reach 2 million people and at least 2% of them will probably buy the record and, you know, then you do a numbers. You know what I'm saying?
It's
kind of weird, but yeah, I think labels have kind of lost touch in a general sense. And what, you know, the protector of what that used to be was A&Rs. And it's like, you know, their job is a bit more widespread now. And people, it's not so cut in stone, you know, it's not so like cut and like rigid of what that used to be. But that used to be like, you know, an A&R find an artist and they find a producer and they put all these people in a room because they had a vision that matched the artist's vision. The producer's call came together and they made something tight and it was dope. And it was, and you know, it still was able to fit in the lines of what the album, what the label wanted to get out of the album.
Well, for simplicity's sake, we would say that your music can be categorized as like soul, right?
Yeah, I've tried every label, and what I've learned is that people call it whatever they want. So then I just kind of stuck with one thing that all the other things that people make in terms of like the type of stuff I make, I guess it all comes from that one genre. It's all influenced from that. So I just left it there.
What era do you think has propelled it further? Do you think it was like the D'Angelo, Erykah Badu, Common Dilla era, or like the Catriona, Anderson .Paak era?
Oh man, obviously it had to be the former, because yeah. Catriona and them, they wouldn't have a leg to stand on if it wasn't for the Erykah Badu and J.L. Scott. Catriona and Samino and all those cats, they take a lot of pull from like house too, but you know that goes way back too. Like,
90. I always thought he pulled it from like his actual Haitian background. His father played traditional Haitian music, and there were elements that, you know, in my opinion, maybe developed his ear for different sounds. And some people will say he's a mix of soul and electronic music, but I hear salsa, I hear Haitian music, I hear the nuances, and I really think that there are two ways to develop that ear, like two concrete ways: being exposed to multiple genres of music early on, or moving around a lot like yourself. And I think you're in the latter. So what brought upon that like nomadic childhood?
You know, it's kind of weird in a weird way, because when I, you know, I always tell people, man, I didn't really grow up listening to music in the sense that like everyone else did. Like, I guess my family was very like religious. They're like super Christian, and like, I was always around like gospel music, but it wasn't like the cool, soulful gospel music that everyone else kind of thinks of when you say gospel. Yeah. They listened to like a lot of contemporary and stuff. And obviously there was like a lot of hymns and like old stuff too. And yeah, I mean, I got my fair share of like Donnie McClurton, Kirk Franklin, all those guys. But it wasn't until I was in like later middle school, high school years that I really started to get into artists like Ty Tribbett and all those kind of people that really take music to another level, even outside of the lyrical content. It's just like creative music and intensely creative music and kind of like genre bends, I guess you could say. And so I grew up playing in the church. At that point, I started playing piano in the church. And so that was a huge influence on me. And I remember there was a drummer that I met who played at a different church. And he would always take me around to all these random like gigs, all these random church gigs where they were playing like soul and stuff, accompanied with all types of instrumentation. And I think that's kind of what originally opened my ear to being like, oh, this is what I really want to listen to. And he would put me on to people like Jay Davey and like all these underground like R&B soul cats. I was like, oh, this is tight. And that's kind of where the musical journey really started. And that was around the same point in which my older brother like was really getting heavy into producing. And since I couldn't really hold a flame to that, I was like, I'm going to songwrite instead. And so I started writing like R&B kind of tunes, and just all of that mixed in together is where it really started. But that transformed quickly into like hip hop when I hit like high school, and a homie was like, oh, you like all these people? You should listen to The Roots. And I was like, The Roots? What the heck is The Roots? Like the movie The Roots? Like, so I was like, all right, let me check it out.
Yeah. I think people are going to say like, oh, you didn't listen to music growing up. Like that's an anomaly, but it's funny. Like even as a kid, if you're not listening to music like that, and I've interviewed a lot of people on this podcast who told me they didn't listen to music either, but they played video games and like maybe the Streets of Rage 2 soundtrack or the soundtrack to Final Fantasy 7, like kicked off their love affair for it. Like for me, it was watching wrestling as a kid, like hearing that bass line on like The Rock's entrance music, or when you heard Stone Cold's music Glass Shatter, there was this fight I had in my mind where when that initial pop happens, the second you hear the music and people are losing their minds, is it because of The Rock or Stone Cold, or is it because of the music? And could music elicit that kind of reaction? So I could listen to my dad's jazz CDs all day, but my early childhood brain is going to respond better to stuff like that. You
know? Because that's where we relate. That's what we had point of reference to. Like, oh yeah, like that sound or that feeling or whatever was associated with something you that you like to do, right? So that makes sense. Like, oh, I'm watching, you know, wrestling or watching my brother play Super Mario or whatever the case is, and hearing those melodies and stuff, that's going to stick with me longer than my dad's jazz CD, which I, you know, at a young age might not have had the ear to really comprehend what the heck that guitar player was doing or whatever. So like, I wasn't like some crazy cool musical genius at the age of like 9 where I really understood and could digest, you know, all the different things that were around me. It was just more like, oh, here's a thing.
Yeah, I was always wondering, like, you know, why isn't black gospel music able to cross over in the mainstream? Why do we have to separate the two, where Kirk Franklin couldn't share the charts with Gerald Levert, you know, because it's obviously inspired. It inspired Kanye West. I mean, people like to take, pick, and choose the best parts of gospel music, but it can never have legs to stand on its own. Now, just from a Billboard, you know, vantage point, like... Are people protective over gospel music to the point where they don't want it to leave the confines of the church walls? You were there when I had nothing. You've been with me from beginning to end. You bring the sun. No clouds in the sky. That's the reason why. Question number one. What can I do? Question number two. What
can I say? I think actually, to be honest, well... To be fair, I'll answer one part of the question than the other. Right now, if you listen to Daniel Caesar's Freudian, so many of those melodies are ripped from full-on gospel songs.
Is that obvious? Or because you grew up in the church, you know that?
It's obvious for any person who's listened to a decent amount of gospel music, because the songs aren't like underground gospel. They're like really mainstream, like... legendary gospel songs from legendary gospel acts like Donnie McClurkin and stuff. Like, it's like a huge, like they're songs, and it's obviously a nod. It's not like he's like trying to steal a thing. It's like, oh yeah, here's a melody and a similar chord progression that's from this song, and I'm going to completely use that, but then replace the lyrics to make it mainstream. And I think a part of that is commentary and being like, yo, it's just as good as anything else. But to take it way back, I think another reason why a lot of gospel music isn't crossing over into mainstream, it's just because a lot of the most popular gospel music isn't, it kind of sounds old, man. It still sounds like, like Jackson 5 in a way. Like, it still has that, the way they record the sounds and the mixing and everything, it's kind of stuck in that era. But there are huge gospel acts, Teeter the Line, that's like, oh, I do this mainstream thing, I'm selling platinum records, but I'm also a gospel act.
Am I going to be able to extract anything spiritual just by listening?
I mean, I think in a very general sense, sure. I don't necessarily flaunt all of my like spiritual or like deeper beliefs, because I don't think that that's the point of my music potentially. Like, I think the whole idea behind what I'm trying to create is to just kind of show the similarities between everything that everyone is believing in and all this stuff. People try to make it seem like it's so far, it's like so disconnected or whatever. But I don't really necessarily believe that. I definitely think we all are living in a different experience. And depending your look or height or age or belief or race or whatever, you can definitely live a very, very different experience. But at the core of it, like, we all kind of believe in very, very similar things. Like, we all want to believe that in some way, shape, or form, there's a power that's greater than ourselves that is going to, that kind of like weighs in, whether it's like a biased thing, like a God choosing a specific group, or if it's just the universe acting as if the universe is in all its random and like chaotic, like beauty. It's just we all want to believe in something, that this isn't just it. I mean, for the majority of us, obviously there's a lot of people who don't, like, you know. But I think my music kind of like speaks in that way. Sure, definitely. And from an experience standpoint, I definitely talk about what it's like to grow up having a parent that's a pastor or,
you know. Oh, they were actual preachers.
Yeah.
Both.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you know what? If just, it comes to mind really quick, Aretha Franklin, Nina Simone, mm-hmm. Wyclef, Sam Cooke, Marvin Gaye, they all had pastor parents. There's got to be something there.
people always ask me, like, it's, you know, when I perform, like, how did you learn how to perform? Like, I learned how to perform by watching my dad preach. It all manifests in different ways, but some of the same things he does on stage, I've noticed that I do on stage subconsciously. I don't even realize that I'm doing the same thing, you know, It's like, it's either in my blood or I've just seen him do it enough times where I'm like, that's how you move a crowd.
Oh, well, that's interesting. Well, you know what? Like, so when I got your information that, since you're just starting out, there's not a lot of info about you. So the first sentence that I learned about you was that when you were dabbling in music, but I think by happenstance, correct me if I'm wrong, but you applied and got into Berklee.
It was definitely by happenstance. I was in like a hip hop group when I was in high school, right after
that. Must have been a hard pill for your parents to swallow then.
In a way it was, but in a way it wasn't, because they were like, you know, I was like that rebellious teen, not how I want to say rebellious. That's so cliche. I was more just like, I knew what I wanted to do. I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And it was one of those things where they, you know, it's hard for any adult to look at a child and be like, he knows what he's talking about at 16. Like, no one necessarily respects children to that regard, or, you know, so it's kind of like, if I'm like, hey, I know what I want to do. This is what I'm doing it already. And I'm going to continue doing it for the rest of my life. That's hard for an adult, especially someone who's jumped around from a bunch of different careers, to be like, oh, this dude knows what he's talking about, you know? And so I had been weighing on them for years, like, this is what I'm going to do. So by the time I graduated high school and I was in this hip hop group, there was a guy, his name was Roderick. He was like, dude, you should apply to Berklee. And I was like, what the hell is a Berklee? Like, what is that? Like, yeah. You know, and I Googled it. And of course the one in California came up, and I was like, yeah, he's like, that's not the right one. There's one in Boston. You should check it out. And I did. And it was so late in the game when he told me, when I found out about it, that when I wanted to audition, the auditions in my area were already over. So like, Berklee sends out all these scouts all over the world, different cities, to like hold auditions there, so people don't have to fly to Boston, because that'd be freaking ridiculous, right? But they were like, no, you already missed that. So if you want to come in, we'll let you apply, but you'll have to fly to Boston to do your audition. So on top of like whatever school fee, like application fee crap, now you got to buy a plane ticket and find a place to stay. So you audition. And once I told my mom, she was like, all right, cool, let's do it. And that was pretty much it. It wasn't even like a, you know, oh my God kind of thing. Cause you know, parents like to show off whatever you're doing. So of course, I'm playing piano at their church. They're going to show me off. I play a talent show. They're going to show you off. Like, oh, my son does this, my son does that. It was kind of all in line with what I'd been pressing. I don't think they necessarily wanted me to be a rapper, but they didn't mind that I was focusing on music.
Yeah, I mean, I can relate, actually. I started playing piano when I was 6, and I was taking private lessons, playing in my church. And when I was in high school, my mom wanted to enroll me in a college, taking higher education, like music theory lessons. And, you know, just doing what a good mother does, you know, cultivating the skills for her son, showing him off, you know. But I caught wind how much each semester would cost. They left the cost sheet out. And I dropped out immediately. Like, my passion for piano didn't match the dollar signs that my mom was willing to throw at it.
Yeah, it's insane. I actually didn't do any formal training until I went to college. So it was kind of, and that's a weird thing, because I remember walking into my Berklee audition, and they were like, all right, cool. So we're going to have you play a couple jams, you know, something you've prepared. We're going to improvise a bit, and then we're going to have you read music. We're going to have you read this sheet music. And I was like, I don't read music. They're like, you don't, or you won't, yeah, or you can't. And I was like, well, more so I can't and I don't. I'm not gonna say I won't, you know. But they, you know, it was just interesting, because I thought immediately, like, I'm definitely not getting into school. I just told these people that I don't read music, like, just flat out, like, didn't even bother trying. I was just like, I don't do that. But I guess whatever I said or did, they were like, you know what, this guy might be onto something. Let's just let him in and see what happens.
That's dope, man. I know you were only there for like a semester or so, but I mean, nonetheless, it's still an amazing story. And I mean, before we started talking today, the first thing you told to me is just how stressful like your new schedule is. So now you're in the suck, and I bet you have a newfound respect for any artist who can complete an album. But for those that don't know, I mean, what about it? What makes making an album incredibly hard?
It's different for everyone. Some people have that, like, it's actually hard to actually make it, like, to find the artist or the producers or the whatever that you need to actually create it. And I think that that's probably the easier part for me. just because of the network of people that I've been able to garner from spending, you know, I was at Berkeley for like 5 semesters. Those people, a lot of those people live in LA. Like, I can just reach out to these people and I can make music. It's pretty simple. but it's harder to be like, what do I want to say? And what do, like, how do I want to say it? And then, like, what is the vibe that I'm trying to give off? Those things are harder to pin down and then, like, execute with such a pointed, like, thing. Like, if I was just putting together, like, a compilation, like a, you know, almost like a mixtape, or, you know, just like a regular album that's not so, you know, you have your Section 80s and then you have your Good Kid, Mad Cities. You know what I'm saying? And I think the hardest part of that is the direction. Because before I started working on this album, I already had like 15 songs written, recorded, that I'm just piecing out as singles in the meantime. When we started to put together this album, we were like, I'm not going to put any of those on the album. I want it to be a completely new and very pointed direction of what this album is going to be about, what it's going to say, and how it's going to sound. I have like a really good idea of what I want to do. So that's probably the hardest thing. And then the other part is the visuals, like everything you see. It's really hard to pin down exactly what that's going to be. And even harder to find someone who can do it if you're not going to do it yourself.
I'm a graphic designer as well, so I know the struggle. Everything's got to look nice.
Exactly. So I work full-time in graphic design as well, and I do marketing for other artists. And it's even harder when you're doing it for yourself.
Well, I mean, I get that. And then, you know, you just told me like how much music is being made versus how much music will be on the album. If you've created something from like 2016 or 2017, even if nobody's heard it, in your head, those songs are very old. And I think some artists treat it as an affliction, like giving you the illusion that those songs are not hot anymore. And they just start tripping
out. Mm-hmm. I used to think the same way. I used to feel like, man, these are terrible, or they're like old, or they sound dated. And sometimes it's true. It does sound dated because the production can get stale, right? Over years, like things change. But if I'm being honest, the first time I started working on Apology was probably back in 2015. And that song just came out this year.
Sounds fresh though. It's fresh.
It went through so many different iterations of production since the first moment I wrote it, but it's been finished, quote unquote, like a gajillion times. It's just that we were able to finally jump over the biggest hurdle in artistry, which is you need to make something that sounds relevant before it's relevant. So that when you're putting it out, it doesn't sound like, you know, so if it takes me a year to make this album right now, I need it to sound like what's going to be relevant next year. I have to have an idea of like, yo, all of the stuff that I'm doing right now is still going to be just as cool. It's either got to be as trendy as what's going to happen next year or as classic as something that'll never fade out.
Well, what about like Leon Bridges, though? He didn't go that route and he was successful.
I mean, I feel like I haven't listened to a whole lot of Leon Bridges, but my favorite stuff from him is the stuff where it's using like a super like classic sounding kind of thing.
Don't remember. Ooh, don't remember. My sins from my youth.
So yeah, the cheat codes. I get it.
I don't know if I have the cheat codes because you know you hear Apology and it's like it's a lot of synth and it's a lot of all these things that are really like in a now moment. But the basis under that is like there's a whole lot of like live instruments, and as we know, like live instruments never go out. Like it's about how you arrange them and how you put them together that may be a certain trend or a sound or an EQ or an effect. But the actual live instrument itself helps to make things kind of like stay fresh. It's like the Ziploc bag. You know what I'm saying? Like people were listening to guitars with Jimi Hendrix. People are listening to guitars with Coldplay. People are listening to guitars with Daniel Caesar. The guitar is not what's changing. It's just how you're using it, right? But there's a through chord that you can kind of I would say there's a safety net, I guess, when you're using live instruments, because synths can go out of style really quick. Like you have your 80s synth, you know what I'm saying? And then you have the 2000s kind of synth, the doom kind of synth kind of stuff. Those are so particular, but it's not as particular when you're listening to like live instruments. There's a little more like longevity with it. And I tend to gravitate towards that. And obviously a lot of that is opinion, but there's some fact based in that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I bet you this is a lot of conversation that you're having in the studio behind the scenes as a co-producer. I imagine it's a lot of back and forth, collaborating to and fro. But ultimately, if this is a tango, you're leading because it's the music that will live on as your legacy. It's going to have your name on it. So is that a balancing act in itself between like ownership and, I guess, if you're smart, working with people that are better than you at certain things?
If you're the best guy in the room, you're in the wrong room.
I hear that.
But I would argue that all the musicians that I work with are definitely 100% better musicians than I am, by far. But it's cool because we all bring something different to the table, and it is definitely a give and take. There's a balancing act that's always happening, and part of that balancing act is ego, right? You have to have enough ego to feel confident in what you're creating. You need to have enough backbone to stand behind something, even if no one else believes in it. But you can't be so stubborn and pigheaded that you're not humble enough to listen and take advice and take direction. And it's a weird, like, back and forth kind of thing that happens in the studio. But more often than not, it's like there's a great idea, and then someone piggybacks off that great idea, and then I'm like, ooh, what if we tweak your great idea to fit my great idea, you know, that kind of thing. And it ends up being a masterpiece. By no means could have been created solely by myself. But I think past making music, part of artistry is having the is discerning who's going to be a right fit for you. Because just because someone's talented doesn't mean it's going to work out well.
That's true. Yeah. And I wanted to expand on the ego thing, because I guess here's my stance a bit. If you're newish on the scene, not with that much music in the public eye, and the way you talk and act is directly correlated to the amount of length of being in the public eye, or you're rung on the ladder, the corporate ladder. How do you react to people like Kanye West, as someone who's been in the industry for so long, and someone who's so respected by so many, to whatever your stance is, to directly spit in the face of the people who build him up? You know, as a man and as someone who shares a space with him in this craft, do you feel like he wasn't taking his position seriously enough to realize that what he was saying could directly hurt the very people who built him up to have the platform to say what he's saying?
I'm kind of torn, because a part of me is like, yo, I'm going to sit behind, you know, the convenience of not having as much success as him, because at that level, I have no idea what it feels like to do what you're trying to do. And I don't mean that as a cop-out, as an answer, but I just mean that, like, regardless of how I feel about it, I can't understand fully or even begin to empathize with someone on his level. And I really feel like it's the people who are around him who are at that level and can understand what it really takes should be the people who are like having those conversations with him, if his ego allows. But there's so many things that I don't agree with that he said, ranging from general political topics, but also things that he's just said about Black people and whatnot. But the other thing is, like, aside from that, it's like, I feel like a lot of what the news bigs up and stuff is sometimes out of context, and or we don't know exactly what is actually happening. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember the media frenzy between, like, when he was when he had that meeting with Trump or whatever, and I'm like, I don't even know what these fools were talking about. Like, they could have been having an argument and just came out smiling. Like, who knows?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, he could have been like, yo, you're messing everything up. Like, you know, he's the type of person that's going to speak his mind, obviously. So I really don't know. So it's kind of hard to speak on just a couple images or like a couple quotes out of context or whatever the case is. But the stuff that we all know about, where he was talking about, like, you know, Black people being lazy or this and that and third, like, nah, I obviously don't agree with that. Like, that's kind of crazy. But at the same time, he's already come out and been like, hey, you know, I've had like hysterical moments. You know, there's all types of stress and other things. And like, who am I to ignore the mental state of someone, especially when it's so obvious that in a lot of the Black communities, especially with men, they don't really consider mental health as a serious health issue. And it is.
Well, yeah. And I asked that question because I disagree with your first point saying that, well, I'm not on Kanye's level, so I can't speak on it, because I'm listening to a lot more Matt Rose music than Kanye nowadays. And if that's just one person telling you that, whatever, but it's true. But I ask that question because some music, most of it is so fabricated and narcissistic because we build up this wall around ourselves that no one can hurt us as rappers and musicians. And I really want to strip that away and show that you can still make bangers, so you can have a message, and it doesn't have to be corny and contrived. It can be positive and it can be real. Like, you have that lyric, tell me what you know about a sacrifice. I don't need permission to deal with what I'm dealing. You know, whether you're crafting music in a studio or a tiny one-bedroom apartment in Hollywood, I feel like you can speak on it. I feel like you have a really good grasp on the issues. And, you know, I really appreciate your perspective on that matter.
To that point, I do agree. I guess where I felt like I don't have the say, or where most people don't have the say, is that as ordinary people, or at least as, like, you know, not to say that Kanye's not an ordinary person, but he has a certain level of, like, visibility that weighs on his brain, something that we can never, like, or at least at this point in my life, I cannot understand. Like, I don't know how to fathom what it's like to wake up and have millions of people constantly wondering what I'm doing at the very moment that I'm, like, peeing or eating a bagel or something.
Yeah.
And, like, everything that I say becomes news, whether I mean it in a good intention or I was just angry. Like, I mean, like, my girlfriend gets upset and says something outside of her neck at me or whatever, and it's like she only has to deal with me, or she only has to deal with, you know, me being upset. And at the same point, if she was Kim Kardashian and she said something outside the neck, then she's got to deal with a million people backlashing at, you know, and what does that feel like to have your phone blow up with Twitter comments or Instagram comments or Facebook or blogs or posts and photos and that stuff? How does that feel when you had a vulnerable moment? You know, I can't relate to that. I have no idea what that does to your psyche.
That's true, because the problem with being successful is you can do whatever you do times 10 and no one like stops you. You can easily go down the wrong path and you get into that place, and the thing that brings you out is usually other people, but, you know.
Yeah, and that goes to show you, you know, and I had a friend we're having a conversation. I guess he knows some of the people that Kanye knows. And he was like, some of the stuff that he said that I've heard him say that I don't agree with is the same stuff that the people that I know he's hanging around are, you know, they're saying the same stuff. So it's just, you know, birds of a feather. So you can't count on these people to get you out of a bad spot if they're the ones that help you get in it, you know? And I mean, it's not just Kanye. Like, there's so many different artists that have gone down that path, like, of the path of just being, like, somewhat reckless of what they say or do. Like, so many artists, man. Like, look at Bieber when he had his whole stint and run in with the law, the car crash, all of that, whatever. You know, like, it's just, you know, There's a laundry list of celebrities that have that same issue. And I think that it's pretty obvious at that point that either it's something that's a part of their character that makes them, you know, have that draw to be a celebrity, or it's the fact that they are a celebrity and how that's weighing on their brain. It's one of the two, or maybe a combination of the two.
Matt, as an independent artist, I'm really happy that you wanted to come on the show so I can contribute a brick to the house that you're building, so to speak. And by the time this episode comes out, the world will be privy to Pay the Bills. I'm actually going to open up this podcast with that song. And spoiler alert, this podcast doesn't pay the bills either. So it's all about love, passion, drive, and purpose. And I'm sure, Matt, you can attest to that.
No, I definitely can. And I remember when we first stumbled upon your podcast, and I checked out a couple episodes and just, like, looking, I was like, oh, this dude is he's legit. There's a lot of interviews that I've done where the questions are, like, ultra generic and it's just boring, and people don't really put the energy or the effort into making something that's worth listening to. And to be real, you know, it's kind of tough to do that if you don't really 100% vibe with someone's music, or you're not, like, you know, you're not really in tune with what they're saying. And I think a lot of people kind of fake the funk. So it's definitely a breath of fresh air to just be, you know, involved with a conversation that actually has some meaning and weight, and it's beyond my music. It's actually music as a whole, and kind of all the different people that have an influence on, you know, what we're creating right now, whether it's a podcast or, you know, whether it's an album or whatever the case is, you know.
Yeah, man, I appreciate that. There is one generic question I'm going to ask you, though, and that's where can everyone find you? Your website, Spotify, you know, the whole nine. I'll give you the floor.
Yeah. So I am Matt Rose. So I am mattrose.com, Instagram/ I am Matt Rose, Twitter, I am Matt Rose. All of your favorite social media is I am Matt Rose. It's pretty simple. I have a few singles out, like he was saying. Pay the Bills is coming out July 23rd. So by the time this airs, you should already have downloaded it.
All right, man. This was enjoyable. Also, speaking with a fellow graphic designer, thanks for being generous with your time, man. I appreciate it.
Oh, dude, thanks for having me. I can't wait to share this and put this out, man.